The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey, Billy, why don't we tell them what we're about, man?
So we're here to welcome you to the Madhouse Chronicles. It's a talk show with myself, Billy Morrison.
And me, Ozzy Osbourne.
This man, Prince of Darkness. And we watch and react to the maddest internet clips. What do we discuss, Ozzy?
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, all that kind of shit.
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, and all that kinds of shit. Come and join Ozzy and myself. Visit osbournemediahouse.com to get special access to...
Come on!
What do you say? Do you think it's the wildest show on the internet?
This podcast is brought to you by Agape Match. Agape Match is a boutique matchmaking service that helps exceptional singles find meaningful connections and relationships. To learn more about our matchmaking services, online dating makeovers and takeovers, or to enroll in an upcoming group coaching intensive, go to agapematch.com. Welcome to the Ask a Matchmaker podcast. I'm your host, Matchmaker Maria. For over a decade, I've combined four generations of family matchmaking tradition with modern relationship psychology, behavioral science, and dating trends. With this unique expertise, I answer your dating and relationship questions on the podcast and online. If you're not already following me, you can find me on Instagram. I'm at Matchmaker Maria. And while you're at it, follow this podcast, Ask a Matchmaker. This way you get notified whenever a new episode drops. It's usually every Wednesday. I'll see you every week. This week's guest is Kimberly Beam. Kimberly Beam is the CEO of Marriage Helper and the host of her own podcast, It Starts With Attraction. She enjoys researching the ways that attraction affects people personally and the relationships that they hold dear. She's currently working on her PhD in psychology. Kimberly? How do your friends call you?
Kimberly.
Good. Welcome to the Ask a Matchmaker podcast.
Thank you, Maria. I'm glad to be here.
You never hear Kimberly's. It's always Kim's. I love that.
I know. It is. And I really don't like the name Kim. But people tend to just shorten it. I mean, and it's fine, right? We do that. But what really gets me is when people ask me, do you prefer Kim or Kimberly? I say Kimberly and then they call
me
Kim.
Now that's just disrespectful. Exactly. But you know what's funny is whenever I think of like the whole name Kimberly, I immediately think of, I don't know why, is that her name? But I think of like the pink Power Ranger.
Yes, her name was Kimberly.
It was like full Kimberly, right? Like I'm like, okay. And you're wearing pink, so wow.
That's right.
Throwback.
Doppelganger for sure.
So, you know, you've got this, tell me a little bit more about Marriage Helper.
Sure, absolutely. So Marriage Helper actually began 23 years ago. So I'm the CEO, but I was not the original founder and starter of But I can tell you how it happened. So the founder, his name is Dr. Joe Beam. You might recognize a similar last name. But it was in the 1980s that he was married. He had two kids at that time. I was not one of them. And he divorced his wife. Left her for another woman, and they were divorced for 3 years. And during those 3 years, he became an alcoholic, addicted to pain medicines, and actually ended up bankrupt and homeless, living out of his car. And he woke up one day. It wasn't literally a waking up one day, but there was a series of events and things that happened, including him ending up in the ER and being told he wasn't going to make it through the night, that he was going to die. That he realized this is not the life that he thought was going to happen on the other side of divorce. And so he actually went back to his ex-wife and asked if she would take him back. And everyone in her life told her not to do it. But she believed that he was a good person who had done many bad things, but it was worth trying to see if they could put it back together. And they did. So as a celebration of their remarriage, their second marriage, they had a third daughter, who is me, and they also ended up saying, we want to do something to help people not have to experience the pain that we went through from our separation and our divorce. And so in 1999, my dad created this three-day workshop, our Marriage Helper Workshop, which has now been around for over 23 years, and it has over a 70% success rate at saving marriages.
Wow. And at what point do people come to Marriage Helper?
A lot of times, a lot of the people we're currently seeing, it is this crisis situation. So there is either a spouse who's filed for divorce, a lot of affairs. We deal with a lot of affair issues. So either my spouse is having an affair or I'm having an affair and I don't know if I want to stay in my marriage. That's the majority of issues. Either they're separated, they're getting a divorce, or an affair
is going on. Are people coming by themselves, or is it like couples coming to Marriage Helper?
Yeah, we serve both. So we have, at first, I mean, back in 1999 when the workshop was created, it was for couples. And our couples workshop is what holds the 70% success rate. And so that's really what we're known for internationally. And that's what everyone wants to do. But of course, you can't drag your spouse to right. it. And so we ended up over the years creating a kind of a second pathway for what we call the standing spouse. So the one who wants to save the marriage. And so we have a plethora of courses. We have a workshop for the standing spouse as well. So we have ways to serve them until they're able to kind of get their spouse to come back home and willing to work on things.
Do you think like when someone comes by themselves, is there, I remember reading some study and I feel like I talked about this with a couples therapist a few weeks ago, but I remember reading a study about how like if women want coaching in their marriage in a heterosexual relationship and the man isn't interested just yet, or doesn't think that there's a problem. But then if a man decides, like after, like, let's say now there's a dissolution of marriage. Wow, I can't say that word. And then the guy's like, okay, now let's go to couples therapy. That the rate of divorce is pretty, like if the guy has to finally come to get around to it, it's already too late. That accurate? Like, do you see that on your end? Like when I think about those standalone couples, right? How many of them are women? How many of them are men? And then what is the success of those standalone people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. So we have from our audience, it really is 50-50 in terms of there's equal men and women who are coming to us as the one wanting to save the marriage. But I think that the study you're referring, so I don't know the exact study you're referring to, but what I've read and seen is there tends to be that when a woman has decided, has finally gotten to the point where she says, I want out, that it's more difficult for her to change her mind because it is likely that she has been for years trying to get
right. That's exactly the study. That's you're saying it better than I am, but that's what I'm referring to.
Right. Yes. And so to that other point, then typically if the husband's been, what's that? Deaf. I was like, what's the opposite of blind? If they've been deaf to it, then by the time they're like, oh no, she's leaving. Right. Like she's filed for divorce or she wants out. That's when the wife's like, you're not really listening.
Right.
However, but we've seen, so that's what the study said. However, we have seen equal success for both.
Okay. All right. And what is the most popular reason? I mean, it's funny. I just had Dr. Terry Orbeck on, who was like, we were going, you know, she did the study on happy marriages. Like, you know, the NIH had, you know, funded the study. And it was interesting how, like, you know, age was a factor of, like, how many people would, you know, how much the divorce rate was based on your age, like when you decided to get married, and also how much financial, what was the word you used? Was it financial stress or some other word, but nonetheless, like something like with financial stress, what kind of impact that has on a relationship. And so, you know, it's like funny, like I hear you speaking and I think, oh, it's probably people cheating, but there's also other things that could be taking place. What do you see as reasons that people would be like, okay, I need your help, Kimberly?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to present this in two in two different ways. So there's the first, which is the more research-based answer. If we look at what Dr. John Gottman has studied as the top three reasons marriages end, it's going to be because they don't feel, the person doesn't feel liked, loved, or respected.
Right.
Everything else is a symptom of that in some way, even affairs.
Right.
Although that's a pretty large presenting symptom, right? Like you're involved with another person, therefore I really don't feel liked, loved, or respected. But some of these other presenting symptoms, the biggest one we're going to see is affairs. The second biggest, right up there with it, is going to be I'm controlled. You're controlling me. You want me to be, act, look, do a certain way. And I don't feel like you fundamentally accept me for who I am without me having to change.
I feel like that is so many couples without them even realizing how much control exists. Oh, I'll give you a really personal example. I was recently speaking with someone and they were telling me how, you know, they're on their own, you know, weight reduction journey, right? They've been reducing their weight over the last year. And their partner said to them, I don't think our marriage is going to last if you lose more weight. And for the first time ever, she was like, oh my God, like weight has been a control factor here. He felt that if I'm overweight, then I would be with him. I won't think now he considers her like, you know, her weight loss that I guess she looks better in his eyes. I don't know, but he thinks now she can do better. Even though she had no intentions of ever leaving the marriage, she's happy. This is now what she's hearing from her partner. And I was like, at first I was like shocked, but then upon telling other people this, they were like, no, Yoda, that happens. And I'm like, what? That's a form of physical control and emotional control.
Yeah.
And do you see this as well? Do you see, like, what kind of control do you see? Just like financial or like time spent, time management? Or do you see like other aspects of control?
Yeah. So it could be finances, but I mean, it could even just be how they think, like what they value, how they vote, right? Like all of that, especially in the past year or two, has become even more of an issue of if you don't align with me, if you don't believe exactly what I believe about politics and health policy and blah, 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 then you need to change. Like you need to change your way of thinking. And even to, you know, well, what about, so even before the past 2 years, we saw a lot of women specifically in this situation who their husbands didn't want them to work. So we worked with one couple, for example, who the husband said, I don't want you to have a job. You just need to be a stay-at-home mom. You just need to focus on raising the kids. But the woman wanted to work. But she was like, well, I guess if he's working so much to provide me this lifestyle, then I shouldn't work. I should just do what he wants me to do. I should just do these things. And now they've been married 20-ish, 21 years. And she's saying, I wish I had more to my life than this. I wish, because she's lost her identity.
Total identity loss.
It's all been wrapped up.
Around kids.
In her husband.
And kids, right? Like,
and kids,
I find, it's like funny. I love talking to people who talk, like I love talking to couples therapists and, you know, people like you, Kimberly, who work with, you know, couples, because I hear the end of it, right? Like when someone comes to me, when a divorced person comes to me, I hear their version of events. But I never get to hear like, well, what instigated this or what started this? And it's like, sometimes I see, I'll talk to some women, not so much anymore because those people tend to age out now, but like in the sense that, you know, Gen X and this issue is less now because their kids are older. But I remember like 5 or 6 years ago, we would meet so many women in their divorce who were like, you know, just like you said, like, oh, I've been, you know, I was tasked to be the stay-at-home mom. But then once my kids went to first grade, it is a loss of identity because your whole life has wrapped around these kids. And now what am I doing? And I'm not saying that someone shouldn't be a stay-at-home mom. Please don't, anyone listening, don't misunderstand what I'm saying. Right. I think I could not do it. That is so hard. But I can understand the difficulties of transition when the people that you are parenting all day now go somewhere else for a third of that day.
Mm-hmm. Right. Absolutely. And I mean, fill in whatever you want with it. Cause it could as easily be a wife whose husband wants to leave his job and become an entrepreneur.
Right.
And the wife is like, no. Right. It's a sense of, you don't support me. You don't support what I want to do or my dreams or my vision. And there's not an area for compromise. Instead, it's a, you can't do that. Or if you do that, I'm going to do something else. It's a way of controlling. And the other side of, if they don't do what you want them to do, there's a punishment involved. So that's what we're talking about here. So if a woman says, but I want to be a stay-at-home mom, like that's what I want to do. Great. Awesome. That's awesome. And my husband supports me. Awesome. But it's for either gender, the one who's like, but I want to do something else, whatever that something else is. And the other spouse is saying, you can't.
Right.
That's control.
Right. Wow. Okay. I never thought of it that way. But that's a lot of relationships.
Yeah. Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
You just like blew my mind. Now I'm thinking about my parents.
So I'm trying to even think now of my relationship. So I know that especially when my husband and I first got married, and I didn't understand when we were dating that he was an introvert because we dated long distance and we only saw each other every other weekend. So the time we were together, he was a super extrovert, right? Like we would go out and do all these things. But then when we got married and we were living together and he needed this alone time, I was like, what do you mean? What are you talking about? And so I tried to control him with that. It was like, no, you can't do that. You shouldn't do that. You're wrong for wanting that. And so you can see how that would be a terrible downward spiral. And it was until we finally, fixed things.
How did you fix it? I have my own solution for this too, but I'd love to hear your solution. How did you fix this? Are you extroverted, first of all?
Yes. Okay. But I've become more of an introvert over 11 years of marriage. But yes, so back then I was very, very extroverted. How did I fix it? It started with me accepting this is not him being broken. Right. Like this is not something wrong with him. This is who he is.
Right. Acceptance and acknowledgement can really go a long way here.
Acceptance and acknowledgement. And then giving him the time, because at first, for the first several months, I just didn't even want to give him the time. Because to me, it felt like he did not love me. Like he was trying to get away from me, or I had done something to cause this. But when I finally realized, you know what, if I give him that time that he needs, and I don't push it, and I don't, whine about it and all those things, then he actually is more able to connect with me better and be more willing to go and try new things with me or go explore, over the weekends and to new cities and things like that. So that's how we handled it.
I'm also married to an introvert and I'm the most extroverted person on the planet. I gotta say, the pandemic has been like really hard on me. I didn't realize how hard it was on me until I think 4 months ago. I went out for my birthday with some friends and the high that I felt when I came home, I couldn't sleep until 3 a.m. I was like, oh my God, I miss this about me. Like I miss, it's different to see people over Zoom and it's like a whole other experience to just like be out and talk to new people. And I was just like, oh my God. So I told my husband after, I was like, you got to let me fly. You got to let me do things. Like I need this. And he gets it. But when we first started dating, I also started my husband and I, we had a long distance relationship for a very long time. I knew he was introverted from day one. Like he was able to express that immediately and, whatever. But one of the things that I learned so that we wouldn't get frustrated with each other, and I learned this very quickly, and it's been such a great solution for anyone who's listening that might be in a relationship that's like extroversion, introversion, is having a conversation before going to an event, which is like, what are your expectations for this event? So anytime we go to a wedding or a baptism or some party, we'll have a conversation like, what time are we leaving? This way, when we get to an event, like we had gone to this one event and, it was kind of like a networking event, but we mingled around together for the first hour. Then I parked him in some corner with some mutual friends. Then I did my little mingling hour for like 90 minutes. And then, you know, we had said we're going to leave at, you know, 9 p.m. Once it got to 9 p.m., it's like, okay, let's go. Like, there's no extra discussion. There's not me saying, oh, we need to stay 10 minutes. Like, this was the expectation. Yeah. Now we get to leave. I love doing this for weddings too. Like, what time are we leaving this wedding? That way it's like, you know, we have to acknowledge what we both need from this. And, you know, the set expectation is there. It's not like, oh, well, I'm still having fun. We have to stay. No, we talked about this. So that helped a lot. And like you said, acknowledging the other person being an introvert, just as much as they have to listen, Kimberly, I'm sure your husband too, he had to acknowledge that you're an extrovert too.
Right.
And you know, maybe you supplement that with going out with friends once a week or having a hobby that's outside of your marriage, that gives you that room to do that.
Another thing that I like to do, I don't know if this is extrovert versus introvert, but I'm huge into exploring. I just love going new places, trying new things. And so that's even part of our compromise. It's like, okay, but every year we're going to go on a vacation together, just the two of us, to somewhere we've never been before. Love right. That. So there's these other things that we've mutually agreed to. And now it's, you know, 11 years we've been doing it. So it's working.
I love that.
Better.
So tell me a little bit more about LovePath.
Yeah, great. So there is a process to falling in love. And at Marriage Helper, we call that process the love path. And if you follow the process, then you'll fall in love. But if you actually stop following the process, because it's not a one and done, then you can fall out of love, even if you don't mean to.
So wait, is this in marriage or in a relationship? Or is this like
in a relationship
before when you're single?
Yeah, it starts when you begin dating.
Okay, all right. Tell me more.
Yes. Tell you more. So the first step of the love path is attraction. But there's four areas of attraction. We call it, so it's the physical, intellectual, emotional, and spiritual, which we call the pies of attraction. And it gives more of this holistic framework to really what people are attracted to. And I'll break each of them down pretty quickly. So the P is physical attraction. It does have to do with looks, but more than looks, it also has to do with how a person feels about themselves physically. So how is my energy levels? Am I getting enough sleep? Am I in a healthy, you know, range and activity level for my body? Not necessarily, am I good looking enough to be on the cover of a magazine, right? Like that's unrealistic. So the question we have to ask ourselves is, am I the most attractive that I can be for my age and situation in life? And then do the best we can with that. The I stands for intellectual attraction. Now, in a relationship, this is all about, am I with a person or am I a person that other people enjoy talking to? So in a relationship, it's especially when you're dating, this is the part where maybe you've seen the person, you're physically attracted to them, but now do you have anything in common? And you don't want to have everything in common because then they're just a clone of you. There needs to be just enough difference that there's interest and intrigue and fascination with them. But there does need to be enough shared experiences or shared values or shared hobbies that you have things that you can go off of together, that you can go do together, like travel, like whatever it might be. So intellectual attraction, is this a person that I enjoy talking to? Emotional attraction, in a relationship, this is the most important part of attraction. And most people don't even realize that it is a part of attraction. Because emotional attraction is all about, do I evoke emotions within other people that they enjoy feeling?
Ooh.
So going back to what we were just talking about a minute ago, I'll give you a story here. I had a friend who several years ago was dating. She started dating this guy in winter and things were going great. It was all good. Summer comes and they start going to the pool together, to the beach. And he looks at her one day and he says, you know, you'd look a whole lot better if you lost about 15 pounds.
Yikes.
Uh-huh. Like, most women are like, I'm gonna drop an elbow on him, right? Like, how in the world could he say that to her? But this goes back to, he did not evoke an emotion within her that she enjoyed feeling. Because after that, she's like, I'm not good enough. There's nothing I can do that's going to be good enough. And then she began to see this be a pattern in his behavior and things that he said over time. And she didn't want to be in a relationship with him anymore.
Right.
So emotional attraction is all about, how am I evoking emotions within others that they enjoy feeling? And then spiritual attraction is about shared beliefs and values. So faith can and is a part of this for people who are people of faith, whatever that faith looks like. But it also just has to do with, do we have similar passions? Do we have similar things we care about that we can align with each other on them? And so those are the four areas of what leads us to be more attracted to one person over another. And it begins at the beginning of a dating process, but it never stops being important even well after you've been married.
It's so interesting, the similarities in the titles, but how different you're evaluating. Like, so I have a program called the Agape Intensive, and it talks a lot about, it revolves around chemistry, compatibility, and search. And our compatibility pillars include all four of those. We have a five, the fifth one being financial. But we are evaluating, like, real, you know, you're talking about attraction from the lens of attraction, which is so different to like what I'm evaluating is in terms of like long-term compatibility. And I think that is like so interesting to, you know, the how different the lens is. I 100% agree with it. But I just find it really fascinating how we can have the same things and just view them from these different lenses for the overall person. Because so much of what you just described is not necessarily about compatibility, but it's about like, do I admire you as much as you admire me? Do I respect you as much as you respect me? Do I like you as much as you like me? Not like, okay, if we have certain things, will this go the distance? There are plenty of people who are perfect on paper, but when you meet them, you're just not, that's it. You're not attracted. And I think that's what you're describing, which I think is really fantastic. And so you teach these four steps, or would these be considered steps then? Or parts?
Well, these are the four parts of attraction, which is just step one.
Okay. Oh, okay. All right. So this is step one of four.
This is step one of four. So all of that is step one of four. So attraction is what leads us to want to move closer to another person. When we see those four areas and we're like, you know what? I align. I see things I like, so on and so forth. Then it moves into step two of the love path, which is acceptance. And in this stage, it is basically at its core, is this a person that I can accept them for as they are without them having to change, even if they never change? So this goes back a little bit to the conversation we had a minute ago on control. It's really asking that question, flaws and all, differences and all, shady past and all, is this still a person I can accept for who they are, even if they were to never change, knowing that the goal isn't that people never change, but the question is, can I treat them with unconditional love as if they were never going to change?
Dating them in the present instead of the potential. Mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, you might see this in the side of things that you are more in, but a lot of people will enter into, or they'll think about entering into a marriage thinking, but they'll change. Right. Like, this person will change. That bad behavior, it'll get better once they're married. Right. No, if you can't accept it about them now, don't assume it's going to get better after you're married. It'll probably going to get worse.
What's the third step?
The third step from there goes into attachment. And attachment is, will this person be there for me no matter what? Will they be there for me physically when I need them? Will they be there for me to talk to comfort me, to guide me, to just let me vent to them? Will this person drop whatever they're doing and come to me when I need them to? And so attachment, as you've probably done research on or had people on your podcast about, it's been around. Like,
attachment, we talk about it all the time. We talk, everyone who's listening to this podcast knows exactly what attachment is, but please, of course, summarize.
Well, it's become the new like psychological fad, right? And that's not a bad thing necessarily, but it's always been important. It's always been so important in relationships.
Absolutely.
And it's this felt security that people are looking for. And so, of course, that's important in a marriage. And it really just boils down to, will you be there for me?
Yeah. And it's not, will you be there for me in like the good stuff? But like so much of life has the messy stuff. Like, you know, your kids might get sick or you lose your job or, you know, one day your parent will die. Like, where are you in yeah. this circumstance of life? As you know, right. in our relationship. Right. Absolutely.
Right. And even doing the hard things to be there for them. So this isn't a marriage example, but it paints a good picture of what it's like. So my husband and I have adopted our children. So we adopted when we adopted them, they were 4 and 2. They're from India. And our 2-year-old son at that time had been in an orphanage from birth and had not been held much.
Oh, wow.
And he was very wary, especially of women. So he did not like me. And I remember the first 2 weeks we had them, we were still in India, and he would have these night terrors. And I would get up, I would go over, I would, you know, pick him up and hold him, and he would just be pushing me away because he didn't want to be held. He, in his heart, like in his spirit, he wanted to be held, but he didn't know how to handle that reaction. And so when we got home, he also would never look me in the eye. He would not look me in the eye. And if you study attachment, especially with kids and
avoidance or anxious avoidance here, right?
He was completely avoidant, not even anxious avoidant. He was 100% avoidant. And so that's a huge step. Like the ability for a child to look you in the eye is a big first step, or it's not even the first one, but it's a big step in attachment. And so I remember I would, to just get him to look me in the eye, I would feed him and I would just hold his food. Like I'd take Cheerios and I would just hold them in front of my eyes. And I would wait until he looked at me and then I would give them to him so he could see, I am willing to meet your needs. I am willing to feed, I am giving you this food. I am here for
you. Where did you learn to do that, Kimberly? Did someone tell you to do this?
We read a book before we went to India called The Connected Child, which is specifically about adoption and attachment within adoption.
Oh, wow.
And in that book, it talked about about attachment disorders and about the need to do what you could to gently touch and look at your child for them to build attachment towards you. So when I saw he wasn't looking at me, I remembered that and I just, you know, said, I'm going to feed you, but I'm going to feed you by like holding the food in front of my face until you can look at me. And then he began to look at me and then he began to slowly mimic facial expressions, which is the next part. And so all of this just paints the picture of like sometimes in order to be there for the people in our lives, we also have to do the hard things.
That's really tough. And I just think it's really great that you had those resources and that you were able to utilize the things that you learned. How is your, if you don't mind me asking, how is your son now? How many years has it been now and how is he now?
Yes. Last month was 3 years that they've been home, which is amazing. And so honestly, he's amazing. I'm going to answer the question two different ways. He has attached very well. Both of our kids have, both my daughter and my son. They have attached very well. So he loves cuddles. He's the happiest kid in the world. Whereas when we got him from the orphanage, we didn't see him smile for weeks. I mean, he was just bitter. You would never know it. You would never know it seeing him now. Now, he's also a 5-year-old boy. So he is, what's the word? Headstrong? Yeah. Stubborn. He's extremely stubborn. Extremely stubborn.
And did you have any, did you experience similar with your daughter?
She was the preoccupied attachment style. So exact opposite. She was the one who was, I'll do whatever you need me to do. I'll be wherever you want me to be. I'll say whatever you want me to say. Just love me.
Don't leave the room.
And yeah, like, look at me. I'm helping. I'm doing things. Like, be with me, stay with me. So she was exactly the opposite.
Wow. Well, I'm really happy to hear that your kids are thriving.
They're doing
That's
very
awesome.
Well. Thank you.
So what is the fourth step?
Oh, and the fourth one, yes, is aspiration. So this is all about creating a shared vision for the future of your marriage. So many times, and you'll get this a lot with what you do in matchmaking, a lot of, when people date, most of the time they're looking towards marriage. That's their goal. They're wanting to get married. And so you're dating, then you get engaged. Once you're engaged, you have this built-in aspiration, so to say, of the wedding, the marriage. After you get married, you have a built-in aspiration many times of maybe the first house or the first job or the first kid. But after those things happen, quickly we stop dreaming together. There's not something that's innately built in there that the couple can begin and continue to look forward to that's going to draw them back together when life tries to pull them apart. So the goal here is, what can you intentionally do, whether that's a dream that you're wanting to build for now, like being able to retire in the Swiss Alps, that can continue to bring you back together, or even something as simple as wanting to go camping together once a month, every month of the year. But whatever it is, what is something you can do that you want to do that can bring you back together when life tries to pull you apart?
Oh my God, I love that. I absolutely love that. Man, I'm going to force every married person I know now to listen to this.
What's your aspiration?
You know, it's aspiration.
You need an aspiration.
That's like a big thing, though. Like, you just basically contextualize the 7-year itch, right? Because like so many things happen for a lot of couples in those 7 years, right? Many couples have children, many people buy their first house and then it's like, okay, after those 7 years, now what? Now what are we doing? Yeah. It can't possibly be just shoveling money into our savings account to like pay off our kids university one day. That can't possibly be the aspirational goal. Right. So yeah, I think Kimberly, I think you're totally right. You know, someone could use like, if they were doing a timeshare presentation where they use this fourth aspect in a slide, because it's like, this will save your marriage. You could look forward to this together every year and go to different locations every year. Like, that's the sales pitch.
That's funny.
Yeah. Right. And so yeah. I think, yeah, I could totally see where aspiration. So when you look at your couples, then the 70%, what do you think they did right that the 30% not necessarily did wrong, but it just didn't work out for that 30%?
The biggest difference in the 70% is that both of the people were able to catch a vision of how their marriage could be different in the future and work the path to make that happen. Whereas in the other 30%, there was one of them that didn't see the vision. They didn't see that there could be a different future for their marriage and therefore decided to leave. So it's not necessarily going to be there was something different about the couple or what they did versus didn't do as much as it is what the people in the marriage believed was possible for a different future.
Right. Well, Kimberly, this was like really awesome. Where can people learn more about Marriage Helper?
You can go to marriagehelper.com. We also have a free mini course on there. So for any of the listeners that are married or in a relationship that it's not going well, then it's our How to Get Your Spouse Back mini course. You can get it there. We also have YouTube, so you can go youtube.com/marriagehelper. Tons of videos. And then we have a podcast as well called Relationship Radio.
I'm going to include all of these links in the show notes. So if you want to check out all of Kimberly's content and courses, check out those links in the show notes. Kimberly,
thank you
for coming on the Ask a Matchmaker podcast.
I loved it. Thank you so much for having
Absolutely.
Me.
And thank you for listening to Ask a Matchmaker. If you'd like to be on an upcoming hotline episode, follow me on Instagram at Matchmaker Maria. I post a link there sometimes and we chat then. Until then, you can learn more about what I do or enroll in an upcoming Agape intensive by visiting agapematch.com/services. Thank you again for listening to Ask a Matchmaker. Be lovable and more importantly, be likable. See you next week.